Today's airing of Public Health Radio is dedicated to the thousands of people who are killed or injured in wars every year, to those who help them heal, and especially to the advocates and activists and the handful of world leaders who have devoted themselves to working toward preventing wars and the damage caused by wars.
And we look around and realize that in Cambodia, walking around, you look right, left, up, down, there's always somebody on crutches or a prosthesis. You could not look any direction without seeing somebody on crutches or a prosthesis.
The minefields I have seen are not fields. They're areas grown over with small saplings and bushes, because once somebody dies there or is injured, the area no longer is used by human beings.
I grew up in Manhattan, in Central Park. If you told me that there were 5 landmines in Central Park or 1 million landmines in Central Park, I still wouldn't go along the grass. So that, to me, is really the horror of these weapons.
The deeper question is, where does war end and peace begin?
From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. There is no threat to public health greater than military conflict. Wars not only kill and injure soldiers, but over the last 100 years, wars have become increasingly indiscriminate. An ever greater proportion of the victims of war are innocent civilians, men, women, and children who live in or near the theater of war. The damage can be direct from munitions, or indirect, leading to post-traumatic stress disorder and depression that can last a lifetime, to the numerous harms inflicted on the environment in the zones of conflict. And of course, wars almost always put an end to public health efforts and medical care to civilians who reside in these dangerous areas of conflict. Refugee crises often develop when civilians attempt to flee contested areas. And refugee crises always then lead to problems with water supply and sanitation. On today's show, we'll be looking at just one small piece of the enormous harm brought about by war, the public health problems brought on by landmines and other forms of unexploded ordnance left over from military conflicts. So this will be a documentary on the detritus of war, weapons and mines left behind from wars that can cause death and injury for decades after the conflict's end. We'll be joined by survivors of landmine explosions, by the doctors and other health personnel who care for them, by individuals who clear the land of mines and other weapons, by a representative of the U.S. government, and by public health advocates who are working to lessen the threat to future generations from these weapons. Listeners with children should be aware that some of the descriptions on today's show may be difficult for their children to process and understand. I hope you'll stay tuned to explore the public health impact of landmines and other detritus of war. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. When I told a young colleague I work with that I was putting together a radio show on landmines, he listened for a minute and then admitted that he actually didn't know what a landmine was. Many Americans and citizens of other wealthy countries are fortunate enough to be unfamiliar with weapons in general, including landmines, and have no direct experience with war. Unfortunately, for many other people across the globe, primarily those living in poor countries whose homes and farms have served as the sites of military conflict, landmines are all too familiar and are a daily menace to life and limb. So what are landmines? Landmines are explosive devices that are concealed and sometimes buried just out of sight that detonate from the pressure of a footstep or a passing vehicle. Landmines are popular weapons of war because they cost as little as $3 to make and are easily deployed in a variety of locations. Mines have been in military use for centuries, but the 20th century saw a huge increase in the deployment of landmines in virtually every war. Most landmine survivors in the U.S. have been injured as soldiers. Jeff Fredericks stepped on a landmine during his military service in Vietnam.
I was with the 101st Airborne, and in 1968, after some action, we managed to stumble into a ambush situation with landmines, and I was stepped on or was command detonated, nobody knows, but I was the sixth man back in a group, and my leg was blown off and some other people were hurt, and that was the end of the war for me and the beginning of rehabilitation, which it was a whole new kind of war, if you want to think of it, more individualistic. But it was my introduction to pain, to injury, to incapacity, to having my body marred and my appearance marred and my sexuality put on display in question, and numerous other things that people struggle with and don't talk about. I spent 9 months in an Army hospital, which I would say, although the care was great, I have no criticism of the care I received in the military or the way I've been treated by the VA. They have been extraordinary. But nonetheless, the horrors that I saw in the hospital for 9 months far outweighed the gruesome realities of the battlefield in Vietnam. It's far more gruesome and far more pain. I mean, people think of battlefields as full of pain and the trauma of seeing people in pain and screaming, but I got news for them. Anybody who's really been through it knows that the battlefield's over quickly. That kind of trauma, though, the pain is indeed extraordinary and impressive. The real horror is daily life in a hospital of people that have been through that.
These stories are typical. One moment, one wrong step, and your entire life is permanently changed. But these stories are not characteristic of landmine injuries as a whole, because even though landmines are weapons used by military forces, the vast majority of landmine victims, over three-quarters, are not soldiers. Here's Jerry White's story.
Well, I was 20 years old, and I took my junior year abroad studying from Brown University and went to the Holy Land to study in Jerusalem. And it turns out that when I was camping with two American friends in the northern part of Israel, we entered into an unmarked minefield and spent the night. So it's sort of your worst nightmare. You can't imagine growing up, you know, in a small town outside Boston that you'd ever find yourself in a minefield left over from the 67 war. So the mines that I encountered were laid when I was 4 years old and just stayed in the ground until I stepped on one in, what was it, April 12th, 1984.
And what happened then?
Well, it was a beautiful sunny day, and I'm walking down a hillside and suddenly the earth explodes all around me. And I thought it was a terrorist attack. I had no idea what a minefield was or imagined that there would be any weapons underground around me. And my two friends yelled at me to freeze, and they reached me and turned me over, and we saw really what mines do. My lower right leg had been blown off, was shredded, and my left leg was blown open with bones sticking out. And really, I was bleeding to death before their very eyes. So it's a terrifying experience. It especially as it dawned on us that we were in a minefield, so that any move we made, left, right, front, center, even to try to escape this predicament, would put our life in jeopardy. And yet
they had to save your life and somehow stop the bleeding and get out of there. How did they deal with that?
I think there's some courage involved, but one of my friends who's now a doctor in Texas, in Corpus Christi, his name is David Kenyon, he actually had some EMT training and knew how to tie a proper tourniquet, which was probably life-saving, and also did it in a way that probably saved a portion of my lower leg. So he did that, and then they had to figure out how to get me out of there. And so they had an instinct to walk down the harder path in this steep field, stepping on rocks where possible, and not take the grassy knoll path that looked easier, that might have been more heavily mined for all we knew. So the instinct seemed to pay off, since after about an hour of them carrying me gingerly down a rocky hillside and then dropping me on a number of occasions where we held our breath praying to God we'd not explode, we got out. So the good news, because you're hearing my voice, is there's a happy ending that we get out of this minefield alive, all three of us, which is a miracle. But then I spend about 6 months in Israeli hospitals undergoing surgeries and ultimately learning how to walk again on a prosthesis.
But even Jerry White's story is not typical, because most civilian victims live in far-off lands where desperately poor people's lives have been made even that much worse when their land is the site of a military conflict. Mines are lain to deter a competing military force. But then innocent civilians, farmers, children, shepherds, become victims. These are voices those of us in the developed world don't usually have the opportunity to hear, and we won't get to hear them on today's show. And this is not only because the victims usually don't speak English. I asked Megan Burke from the Landmine Action Program, Adopt a Minefield, to describe the magnitude of the problem. Adopt a Minefield is a campaign that supports the effort of the United Nations to resolve the global landmine crisis by raising funds for mine clearance and assistance to survivors of landmine injuries.
The estimate is that there are between 10 to 15,000 new landmine survivors every year. Those are people who are involved in accidents and become disabled. Most people feel that this statistic is an underestimate because of the vast numbers of people who are injured from landmines and other unexploded ordnance in those countries who never even make it to a hospital and they die before they get there. And in addition, the problem is even bigger than that, because once people have become injured, they do need care for the rest of their lives. So while there are maybe 10 to 15,000 new cases each year, that adds to the already very large caseload from the past. So in many countries like Cambodia, you have hundreds of thousands of people who will need care for the next 20 to 30 to 40 years. The saddest part is that the vast majority of victims are not parties to the conflict. They're innocent civilians who are just going about their daily lives and they step on landmines. And part of this is because in most countries where there are landmines, the conflicts are over. So people think that it's safe to resume their lives. And then they, you know, move back to their communities, and as they're going about their business farming or doing other activities, gathering firewood, getting water, they step on the landmines. Because landmines are indiscriminate killers. They lurk under the ground and they'll explode whenever someone steps on them. And it doesn't matter if it's the foot of an adult, the foot of a child, a soldier, a civilian. Everyone, it's an equal opportunity killer. And one of the saddest things in some of these places is that some of these landmines or unexploded ordnance are actually designed to look like toys, which is really quite sick if you think about it. Children see them and they want to play with them and they explode. And that can often mean that those children die, or again, they become disabled for life. And that's a very long life they have ahead of them. Most people believe that at least 25%, and in some cases, depending on the country, as much as a third of the victims are children. in countries that are emerging from conflict, where the healthcare system is typically not what we would like it to be, having additional numbers of disabled people who need assistance from the government for the rest of their lives is really a heavy burden, both for the country and, of course, for the people who are unfortunate enough to have stepped on the landmines.
The data Megan reported on landmine injuries are derived from patients who arrive at hospitals seeking treatment. When American soldiers are injured by mines, the results are certainly devastating, but our soldiers do generally receive quick access to medical care. Jim Kobe is an orthopedic surgeon who has spent much of his career working in some of the poorest countries and has been extensively involved in the treatment of landmine injuries. He was involved in a 1998 study in Cambodia that discovered that about half of Cambodians who step on landmines don't survive their initial injuries. I asked Dr. Kobe why the landmine death rate is so high among injured civilians.
Think of what happens if you step on a landmine. If you step on a landmine, there's a loud explosion. You may lose one leg, both legs, or be dead. People have probably heard the explosion. It's very loud. And if you're lucky, they'll come to save you. But they may be afraid to save you because they may die coming to drag you from the landmine field, as often happens. So you may have to drag yourself back to the road. In the process, you may have to take a knife or a stick and cut off the rest of your leg if it's dangling. I've talked to a number of patients who had to do that themselves to get back to the side of the road because they've had friends who stepped on landmines and relatives have died trying to save them, stepping on other mines. If you get back to the side of the road and you're still alive and not bleeding too much, if you're lucky, there'll be one or two people to pick you up. If it takes two people to carry an injured person, you tie a blanket or a strap to a pole and carry you between the shoulders. It takes about two people to carry you. If you're lucky, they'll carry you to somewhere, a major road, where there's a ox cart, maybe a car or a truck, but often an ox cart, who can take you to a hospital, to a surgical facility. You hope to get there in the next day or two. Remember, in the United States, you get there in a few hours. In a day or two, you hope to get there. You hope you haven't died from blood loss at that time or infection. If you get to the hospital in the next day or two, then if you're lucky, if there's a surgeon there, if there are people there to give you anesthesia, if there are any antibiotics. In the real world, in most countries, in developing countries, there may be, in fact, free medical care. That may mean an empty bed or a free bed, but still you have to pay somebody to find medicines for you, pay somebody to go out and get ether for the anesthesia, simple ether, nothing expensive like in this country, pay to somebody to donate blood to you, which will not be tested for any diseases, and hopefully there's a surgeon around who will help you. And you hope he will help. If you're lucky, you've gotten to an international hospital run by a non-government organization or by the Red Cross. Or you may have gotten to just a government hospital. The government hospital may be excellent or maybe not. In most government hospitals in developing countries, the staff usually is not paid very often. So you may or may not have to tip the nurses and doctors. In any case, you hope and get surgery. If you're lucky, you'll stay alive, and after a month or two of two or three other operations to bridge your wound and clean up, you'll get out of the hospital. That's why half the people die before they get to the hospital.
For those who do survive mine injuries, the treatment and recovery efforts are enormous. Requiring 5 to 10 operations is the rule. And as we heard earlier in the broadcast, Irvin Axelrod had 22 operations. Dr. Kobe has treated many mine victims, so I asked him why they often require so many surgical procedures.
There's dirt in the wound. A lot of dirt exploded into the wound. First operation is usually to do the amputation. Then you may take them back 4 or 5 days later and wash out the wound and clean it up again. Then another or two or three or four times so you can be sure the wound is clean, then you close it. Sometimes you close the wound, you think it's clean, it'll get infected, you have to reopen it and take off more bone and shorten the leg. So it may take 3 or 4 operations initially. Then after you've had the operation, you've got a lot of extra soft tissue that has to so shrink down over a number of months. Even in this country, you make a prosthesis for somebody, and after 6 to 8 months, the prosthesis doesn't fit anymore because all the soft tissue has to shrink. After it's fully shrunk, you may find a little bone spur or bump of bone. You have to go back and operate on it again. So they can take a number of operations before they're finally healed, especially when trauma, when you have all the skin tissues are all contaminated and very ragged.
So the reason for repeated operation is not exclusively to an attempt in a wealthier country to try to salvage perhaps more of the leg than was realistic, but this is something that would need to happen in poor countries too.
And in poor countries, mainly because the wounds are so contaminated. When you step on a mine, it doesn't just cut your leg off. It blows the tissue up into your leg. Your foot becomes the missile. And the piece of the foot bones, the ankle bones, are actually blown up into your lower leg or up into your thigh. I've actually taken pieces of bones and feet out of somebody's eye. So it blows up, so it's not just cut off. It's not like a motorcycle accident. Dirty tissue is blown up into your thigh. And you think you've cleaned it out surgically, because most countries you may be doing this with a flashlight, if there's no electricity in the operating room at night. And then you think you've cleaned out, and you realize there's more dirt there, more dirt there, more tissue there. So it's contamination of the wound and the mechanism of injury that makes it so much more difficult in developing countries.
While the lower extremities are the most common body area to be impacted by landmines, many other body areas can be injured. Devastating eye injuries are quite common after landmine detonations. Larry Schwab is an ophthalmologist who spent years working with mine victims in Southeast Asia. He has seen firsthand the dismal outcomes from landmine injuries to the eyes. I asked him why most outcomes are so poor, even when surgical treatment is available.
Most often, it is not successful. If the injury is penetrating, facilities for ophthalmic surgery and for removal of intraocular foreign bodies, material that has entered inside the eye, are usually scarce or completely lacking. And even in the United States, in the highest technically available surgical setting, an intraocular foreign body often results in severe loss of vision and even loss of the eye. So these injuries are permanent. My role was not so much to treat those people, but to direct them to rehabilitation centers or to low vision centers. But also it engaged me in the international campaign to ban landmines, because this is it's a public health crisis, and it's a man-made epidemic. But fortunately, the good news is it's an epidemic that we can do something about, and that is to eliminate landmines as a source of injury and of killing and of maiming, and in my particular specialty, that of blindness.
As we've seen, landmine survivors face many challenges. Even after enduring the injury and making it through a half dozen or more surgical procedures and adjusting to a prosthesis and coming up with a plan for economic survival, the obstacles that mine survivors face don't end there. Jerry White, a landmine survivor we met earlier in the broadcast, now serves as executive director of the Landmine Survivors Network. Whenever he meets survivors around the world, he's always impressed by their ability to withstand the physical challenges. But time after time, he has also learned of the social stigma and challenges survivors face, both in the developed countries and especially in the poorer countries of the global south.
It's not that the landmine makes us all vulnerable or that injury. It's actually that sometimes the lack of care, the financial stressors that add to the injury, and then society's attitudes towards people who are down and out or different, in other words, people with disabilities living around the world, are among the most stigmatized and rights-abused populations. We're talking 600 million people living with disabilities around the world, 400 million living in developing countries, 80% of those well under the poverty line, begging because of their disabilities. So the layers of vulnerability here go deep, and it isn't just about losing your leg, it's about losing your place in society.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's broadcast is a radio documentary on the public health impacts of landmines and other explosive remnants of war. After a short break, we'll be looking at the strategies to lessen the impact of landmines on the health of populations across the globe. We'll look at the promise of mine removal, the effectiveness of international agreements to limit these weapons, and also the impact of programs to assist landmine survivors rehabilitate and reintegrate into their families and communities. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's broadcast of Public Health Radio is devoted to the problem of unexploded ordnance left over from military conflict, especially landmines. During the first part of the show, we learned of the immense suffering caused by these weapons, the high frequency of death, and severe permanent disability, especially amputations, burns, and blindness. Because they don't recognize ceasefires or treaties, for these weapons, the war is never over. Landmines deprive some of the poorest people in the world from using their lands and their roads. Millions of landmines still lie in wait in at least 80 countries worldwide. And year in and year out, the vast majority of landmine victims are civilians. On the second part of today's show, we'll look at strategies that have been undertaken to limit the human impacts of the epidemic of human suffering caused by these weapons. The first and most obvious response is to raise awareness of the location and danger landmines and other unexploded weapons can pose to communities which have been the site of military conflict. And the other is to provide humanitarian aid to people in these communities who have survived injuries from these weapons of war. Nowhere is the problem as great as in Vietnam. During the Vietnam War, Vietnamese soldiers commonly moved American mines to locations where American troops were moving. This is one of the reasons why at least a quarter of American injuries during the war were from landmines, many of which were originally placed there by the American military. The problem of unexploded ordnance left over from the war is still a major problem throughout most of Vietnam. Martha Hathaway is the co-founder of ClearPath International, an organization devoted to providing assistance to those who survive injuries from munitions left over from war. She became aware of the magnitude of the problem when two young boys standing only 10 yards away from her were injured by a grenade.
I was in Vietnam. I was leading a tour group, actually. Two little boys were blown up. They were playing with...
Right in front of you.
Yeah. I actually didn't see the explosion itself. I heard the explosion and turned and saw the boys. Yeah. So,
and this was unexploded munitions left over
right.
from the war a generation ago?
Yes. Yeah. The boys, well, this was nearly 10 years ago that this happened. One of them was 13 and the other was, I think, 9. And they were brothers playing in their backyard. And they had known about the grenade that had been there. They had known about it for about a month. They had seen it, and they'd even sort of played with it. But one day, their curiosity just overcame them, and they started thinking, well, what would happen if we threw it here, or we threw it against this or that, and they threw it against a rock, and it exploded.
And that day, you happened to be there.
I happened to be there, yeah. It was right in a town. So, I mean, I wasn't out in the middle of nowhere. It was in a town, which happened to be a former U.S. Marine base. So a lot of stuff is hanging around there even to this day.
And what was your reaction to that?
Well, I had known and had some experience understanding of the landmine bomb issue in Vietnam, but certainly my sort of one of those points when I was faced with the choice to accept what had happened and move on or try and do something about it. I was already the mother of a little baby, so I couldn't turn away. I had to do something, and so started working much more heavily in the landmine issue, and then eventually several colleagues and I started our own organization about 5 years ago. So
she co-founded Clear Path International, which provides aid to landmine survivors in several locations throughout Southeast Asia.
Clear Path International support individuals, families, and communities that have been impacted by what the U.S. government has neatly titled or defined as explosive remnants of war. That means bombs, landmines, anything that explodes indiscriminately. And more often than not, that's the case. After wars have ended, innocent civilians are injured at an alarming rate. So we work with those people, try and get them back on their feet, so to speak, both emotionally and financially, so they can lead as productive lives as possible in their communities. Quite often, I think people think of victim assistance or survivor assistance in terms of physical needs, prosthetics, for example. The thing that's important to understand is, at least our philosophy is, you need to look at the whole, the big picture, and work with the survivors or their families to determine what and where their needs can be, how their needs can be best met. Sometimes that's a prosthetic. Quite often it's not. It might be something else, like an educational scholarship for a child in the family, maybe one that wasn't even directly injured, physically injured. Maybe it is some sort of grant to support an improvement to their house or to help them start a small business. So we would like to think that we're very comprehensive in our approach, again, looking at the big picture and helping accident survivors to find the best way to help themselves.
Jerry White, himself a survivor of a landmine explosion, who we met earlier in today's show, is currently executive director of the Landmine Survivors Network, one of the largest survivor assistance programs that has programs in poor countries across several continents. He describes the approach he uses when he's dealing with landmine survivors.
Thank you. There's so much about that I've learned, not only in my own personal situation, but talking with thousands of survivors around the world of all stripes, and particularly in post-conflict countries. We've come up with sort of a recovery model that basically says, face the facts, number one. You've lost your leg, or you're in a minefield, or this has happened to you, now what? Number two is basically a choice. It's almost existential, but with meaning, like choose life. Choose to live forward, not backward, because you can't change what's happened in the past. Three, make a plan. We work with survivors around the world on individual recovery action plans that are their maps, their particular needs for recovery. And then four, connect with people and network, that no one survives alone. We do need family and friends and doctors and nurses and different things. You actually have to connect with people, because otherwise isolation is what kills. And lastly, in your recovery, to give back or pay it forward, as it were, some of the things you've learned, the benefits you've experienced, so you can become a peer counselor, you could help a new businessman with a disability, work in your community. So this idea of being able to give as part of recovery, I think, is very important. So that's, both personal experience, but also what I'm seeing cross-culturally all around the world, that these aspects of recovery that come in different times and different ways to individuals, the elements are mostly there for comprehensive recovery.
While mine awareness and survivor assistance are important activities, removal of unexploded ordnance, especially landmines, is also essential to reduce the future toll of injuries and disability. The HALO Trust is the largest mine-clearing organization in the world, employing over 5,500 mine-clearing specialists on three continents. Back in 2002, they celebrated when they had calculated that they had thus far cleared 1 million landmines. Nigel Robinson has now worked with HALO for several years. I asked him how daunting it must seem to face the task of clearing hundreds of thousands of mines throughout a landmine-infested country such as Afghanistan or Cambodia.
Yeah, it does take a long time and a lot of effort and ultimately money to clear landmines. To clear the whole country of Cambodia, we're talking 10 years, and then you're not going to have every last landmine. There's still going to be odd landmines left out there that have not been found. But as an organization, a humanitarian organization, we focus literally village by village, so going to where the most impacted people are, where we know that people are treading on landmines today. We target those villages, and we're literally going village by village by village with these teams of landmine clearers. And you can have an impact on the literally in people's houses. People have landmines under their houses, so you can have, at the most local level, a huge impact. And then by clearing a village, people can then start farming on the extremities of their village, which means that they can go grow crops, which means that they can then sell those crops on the market, and communities can grow. So we have impact at the community level, and then that gradually, that patchwork of cleared land starts growing across the country, and ultimately you have impact at the nationwide level, but it certainly takes time and effort and money to do this.
As one would expect, there is significant danger when one is demining. I asked Nigel Robinson what he thought about that.
For our deminers, we give them the best training, the best leadership, and ultimately that's the best protection you can give somebody. People wear a protective vest and a visor in case there is an accident. And over the past 17, 18 years, unfortunately, we've lost 36 of our deminers in this activity. It's less dangerous statistically than the food processing industry or the deep sea fishing industry, but we do everything we can to make sure that the deminers are the best trained, the best equipped people. But unfortunately, it's a dangerous profession and accidents do happen.
But there are limits to what private sector organizations can accomplish without support from governments, both because governments control far more resources and also because governments control the actions of their militaries. Concern about the landmine problem in the public sector is not new. As the weapons were used more and more frequently through the 20th century, a number of private sector organizations and a few governments took the lead in trying to develop an organized international effort to limit the production and use of landmines. Finally, in 1981, an international treaty was agreed on by most every nation in the UN. It required that landmines be used only for defense, that they be carefully mapped and marked in a clear manner, so that civilians in the affected areas would know where minefields were located, and they were not to be scattered in a manner that would make mapping less feasible. But mines came to be used increasingly for offensive military goals. Mapping was not useful in poor countries where few maps are available to the population. Landmine markers were far from permanent, and mines were increasingly being airdropped, making mapping even more difficult. So every element of the treaty was either irrelevant or widely violated. Several private sector groups became increasingly concerned and involved during the 1980s. And finally, in 1991, several organizations, including three represented on today's show, joined together to form the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. Over the next few years, campaign members organized with human rights and survivor assistance groups worldwide to join in the campaign. A major breakthrough occurred by 1996 when the government of Canada agreed to host a conference under the auspices of the United Nations, to develop a strong international agreement. Only 1 year later, this conference did produce a strong agreement, often referred to as the Ottawa Accord. That accord banned the production, stockpiling, and any nation-to-nation transfer of landmines. And it also banned all military use of anti-personnel landmines. The protocol also committed signatories to survivor assistance and mine-clearing activities. This treaty was such a remarkable step forward, accomplished in a relatively short period of time, that the campaign was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997, along with Vermonter Jody Williams, who was the campaign's founding coordinator. Over 100 nations quickly signed on to the treaty, and within a few years, three-quarters of the nations in the world, 147 countries, had become signatories of the treaty. But along with Russia, China, and most of the countries of the Middle East and South Asia, the U.S. never signed on to the Ottawa Accord. Physicians for Human Rights was one of the founding members of the Mine Ban campaign. Gina Copeland Newfield, from that organization, worked on the issue for many years and gives her thoughts on the U.S. landmine policy.
President Clinton announced in 1994 that the world should ban anti-personnel landmines, that this was a weapon that the world should no longer tolerate, that it was killing too many civilians and injuring too many civilians, and the world should figure out a way to outlaw them. In 1997, President Clinton failed to join most of the world in actually signing the Mine Ban Treaty, but he did create a policy that put the U.S. on track to join the Mine Ban policy by the year 2006. When President Bush took office, his administration conducted a formal review of U.S. landmine policy and last year came out with the results of this review, and these results were pretty awful for civilians, for public health, for the mine ban movement, for a number of reasons. One, because the new policy abandoned the 1997 U.S. government objective to join the mine ban treaty by the year 2006 or to ever join it. It also abandoned the U.S. search for alternatives to the weapon. It abandoned the plan to get rid of so-called dumb mines by the year 2003 and instead said that the U.S. would get rid of these weapons by 2010. Next, it asserted the need for the possible use of the weapon, which the U.S. has not actually used since the 1991 Gulf War. And lastly, this new policy gave political cover to countries that are either currently using or thinking about using in the future this weapon. So on a number of levels, this was a very dangerous policy.
Richard Kidd, the director of the Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement at the U.S. State Department, has a very different view of that same history.
2001, there really wasn't a policy. There was a commitment to join the treaty that was conditional, and the funds and activities to meet that condition were not in place. So the U.S. government started a comprehensive review of landmine policy writ large, and it wasn't about the Ottawa Treaty, and it wasn't even about landmines. It was about people. What do our people, you know, men and women in uniform, need to succeed on the battlefield? And what do civilian populations in and around battlefields need to reduce their risk? And in this case, the key factor of landmines is that is a threat to people, to civilians, is how long after the battlefield they last. The issue of persistency. And that we will go to a mine inventory that completely self-destructs or self-activates after its use on the battlefield, normally 4 hours, but in some cases as long as 15 days. The U.S. commitment is that we will leave no mine behind anywhere in the world on any battlefield, and that we would challenge all countries, including those who've joined the Ottawa Treaty, to match that commitment, pledge to leave no mine behind. That's the U.S. position. It's strong, it's compelling, it's forceful, and I think that it should be adopted as the new standard.
So how should we regard the Bush administration's landmine policy? On the one hand, the U.S. government provides one-third of the worldwide support for mine clearance, far more generous than any other nation. And we have committed to producing mines that will self-destruct in less than a month, which would presumably be far less of a burden on civilian populations over subsequent years. So for the first time in a decade, the U.S. will again be manufacturing landmines, giving them high-tech names such as Spider and Matrix. I asked Gina Copeland Newfield from Physicians for Human Rights what her thoughts were on the new U.S. landmines.
So-called smart mines are anti-personnel landmines, or anti-tank mines for that matter, that are set to self-destruct or self-deactivate within a particular amount of time. Now, surely these so-called smart mines are better than dumb mines, mines that will just lay in the ground and will go off when a victim sets them off. So certainly they're better, but there is no such thing as a smart mine. There's no such thing as a mine that could ever tell the difference between the foot of a soldier and the foot of a child. And these so-called smart mines are bad for a number of reasons. One is the fact that they are set to self-destruct, but they're not 100% reliable. The landmine protocol CCW, to which the U.S. and China belong, allows for a 10% failure rate. Now, smart mines are usually scattered by aircraft artillery at a rate of thousands in a matter of minutes. And given the failure rate for self-deactivation, many dangerous mines are going to remain in the ground. Next, because smart mines are usually scattered or remotely delivered, there's no way to accurately mark or map these mines in the ground. It's going to be difficult to know exactly where they are. Even if a mine field is set to go off in, let's say, a week's time, if you're talking about conflict where refugees are fleeing a zone where they're in danger, if they cross through this minefield on day 5 instead of on day 8, they're still going to be in grave danger of setting off these mines and being injured or killed. Next, these so-called smart mines will still deny land to civilians, even if civilians are told that a minefield is safe because it was set to self-destruct a month ago, let's say. They're going to be worried about putting their lives on the line and their families' lives on the line to farm that field or to live in that field or that area because they know that there's a chance that some of those so-called smart mines will fail to self-destruct or self-deactivate. In terms of mine clearance, there are a couple of reasons why these so-called smart mines are still dangerous. One is that a certain number of them will fail to self-destruct, and each of these that fail to self-destruct will pose the same danger to deminers as they do to civilians. Deminers have their lives on the line. If they're told a minefield has self-destructed or self-deactivated already, they're not going to just quickly remove the mines from this field and hope that the intelligence that they were given was correct. They're still going to have to approach this so-called smart minefield with the same degree of care and caution and cost and time as they would a so-called dumb minefield. And finally, so-called smart mines are dangerous because experience has shown that nations, especially in the developing world where mines have most been used, are unwilling to give up the dumb mines in their arsenals if wealthier and more technologically advanced nations insist on the right to keep the so-called smart mines in their arsenals. If a country like Cambodia was told in 1997 that the U.S. could keep its smart mines, but they had to give up their dumb mines, which were the only kind of mines they could afford, they and other developing nations made it clear they wouldn't have ever joined the Mine Ban Treaty if it had this kind of caveat.
And here are Jerry White's thoughts on the new U.S. policy. Jerry is himself a landmine survivor and head of the Landmine Survivor Network.
I think the sad thing, or maybe shocking to some Americans, is that the United States and Cuba are the only two countries in this hemisphere that haven't joined the Mine Ban Treaty. Also, the United States is the only one of our NATO allies that hasn't joined the treaty. So Europe can't work with the United States to transfer or do anything related to the use of anti-personnel mines, whether in operations in the Gulf or anywhere else in the world. So you ask yourself, well, what is a superpower like the United States still need landmines for. I mean, of all the things that you're trying to get rid of, this type of weapon that maims and kills and threatens civilian populations, why can't we just give it up? So it's deeply disappointing that in this administration, the Bush administration calculated that we had a new type of landmine that we had developed that could self-destruct and be timed to detonate or to become defunct. And therefore, our landmines were actually more, quote, humanitarian than others. And so that we would take our more expensive high-tech mines and get rid of all the old types that we had exported and used around the world, and just say, well, we can keep ours because we aren't really part of the problem. And by the way, we give more money to demining than any other country in the world. So you're in this sort of strange position, I think, with some of U.S. international policies where you're like, well, how hard is it to ban the weapon if the world's superpower can't give it up? And we're asking other people to. The United States wants other countries also to abandon landmines, but wants to keep it in their back pocket in case they need to use it, given our, you know, security concerns around the world. And our argument is it's like poison gas and chemical and biological weapons. Landmines are a weapon of mass destruction in slow motion. They have killed more people than nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons combined. And the nature of the injuries in the weapon mean it should be banned like poison gas. It's just beyond the pale. And I don't think most Americans want their tax dollars going to weapons that are invented to be victim-activated and to maim. You're like, is that something I raise my hand for? So I say it's apple pie to protect civilian populations and to export that notion of care for those populations, including the next generations of children, as well as environmental protection. So it's very disappointing. You can hear my voice, you know, after years of activism and trying to push the U.S. government as we have other governments around the world, and just see that we can't get a budge. We do get more resources coming out of the U.S. for demining and survivor assistance. So to be fair, there's progress. The U.S. complies with many elements of the mine ban treaty, but just won't join the sort of global verdict against this weapon. And that's deeply disappointing to survivors around the world, because we need U.S. leadership.
And we'll end today's look at the legacy of war with a thought from Martha Hathaway at ClearPath International.
It doesn't take very long to learn that explosive remnants of war come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. And they can be landmines, they can be cluster bombs, they can be grenades, they can be leftover bullets. Whatever it is, they have huge, huge impacts on civilian populations around the world. So what do I think about it? I think a very poignant moment happened in my life recently, you know, not too long ago, when our president declared that the war in Iraq was finished, that mission was accomplished. And all I could think of was, my God, there's nothing finished about this. This tragedy, this death, this bloodshed, even if the soldiers left today, will continue for 100 years, because the landmines and bombs, or what, however you want to define the detritus of war, is indiscriminate. And unfortunately, those folks that have committed their lives to designing weapons of destruction haven't spent a whole lot of time figuring out how to get rid of them after the conflicts are over. So, yeah, I spent a whole lot of time prior to this most recent Gulf War trying to talk to people to get them to understand that this is not a win situation. There's no way that a military intervention can possibly ever be classified as a win. There are only losers.
Well, Christmas is upon us. It's a time when those of us who live in the wealthier countries may take a moment to take stock of our lives and our place in the world. I asked Jerry White from the Landmine Survivors Network what he'd like listeners to think about during the holiday season.
I guess I always want Americans to connect to the world as global citizens, because the ripple effects of our policies and our actions go out all around the world, including whether it be the landmine issue, but on so many issues. So I guess during this time of, as we enter into the holidays, out of our own gratitude of our position in the world and many blessings, I guess I'd like Americans to connect to others to understand why are they connected to that Cambodian girl missing a limb in Phnom Penh who's begging. And not in a way that says, oh, I feel sorry for that poor girl, or pitying, but understand that, no, we actually were part of conflict over in that part of the world, too. And Vietnam continues to fight what they call the American War, even decades afterwards, because they have over 3 million landmines and unexploded ordnance still threatening their populations left over from that time. So it's not, I don't like to be chiding or moralizing, it's just let us wake up during the season and think of how we're all connected, not just in the bad ways of the remnants of war, but also in the positive ways connecting humanity. And to think perhaps we're all survivors. We all are birthed as gifts into this world, and we want to share that with some global messaging, and to think of how we're connected to people. And then I'm so appreciative of when people give out of gratitude. To whom much has been given, much will be required. I guess I was raised on thinking about what are you doing out of your abundance, and how are you giving sacrificially or maybe not so sacrificially, just to give. That's part of our health and our recovery. So I look at my fingers, I look at my hands, I look at, you know, my 1 foot that's left, and I think, what are those worth to me, let alone my life? What is it worth? Obviously, it's priceless. You wouldn't give, someone gave you $1 million, you wouldn't give up your hand or your foot. But just out of that moment of looking and counting of your blessings and your fingers and your toes and your loved ones, just think, you know what, let's give out of that abundance and connect to others in a spirit of compassion and global solidarity during a wonderful global holiday season. So give and support survivors in their mission of reaching out to other survivors around the world, but be one of us.
For those who would like to donate for survivor assistance, I encourage you to learn more about ClearPath at clearpathinternational.org. And the Landmine Survivor Network's web address is landminesurvivors.org. If you'd like to donate for mine clearance, Adopt a Minefield's website is landmines.org. Regarding policy issues, including the Bush administration's new landmine policy, the State Department's web address is state.gov. And the website of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines has a wealth of information on the issue. Their web address is icbl.org. To access most airings of Public Health Radio, our website is publichealthradio.org. Once again, I'd like to thank everyone who appeared on today's show and many others who educated me on this issue. Well, that's it for today's show. Join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.